Welcome to Building a Powerful Movement in the United States of America, KPFK's week-long special on the Occupy Movement. In a moment, we'll hear from Angela Davis, a part of her powerful speech 2 days ago at Occupy Wall Street. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Alejandra Cruz about tomorrow's march in solidarity with the Occupy Oakland general strike and against police brutality. We'll also hear from one of the people who authored a proposal that was adopted last night at Oakland's General Assembly called the Occupation Community Solidarity Proposal, which calls upon the movement to support efforts of the people of Oakland to occupy property that sits idle and unused for the purposes of helping the community. And before that, we'll hear from radical historian and theorist Brian Holmes, who was one of the first people to lead an open forum at Occupy Wall Street. Brian Holmes talks and thinks about the history of political activism and also its relation to human liberation and art. And now to Angela Davis speaking earlier this week at Occupy Wall Street. A couple minutes into the talk, she tackles some of the most challenging issues facing a mass movement in the United States. And I think you'll agree, what she proposes is profoundly beautiful.
You are reinventing.
You are reinventing.
Our political universe. You have renewed.
Our collective passion.
You have reminded us. That it is still possible. To build. Vibrant communities.
Of resistance.
You continue to show us. Your commitment. Your dedication. Your collective labor.
Your collective labor.
Your refusal. To assent.
To class hierarchies.
To racial hierarchies.
To gender hierarchies.
Sexual hierarchies.
We have come together.
As the 99%. There are major responsibilities. That are linked to your decision. To assemble here.
In community.
How can we be together?
How can we be together?
How can we be together in a unity? That respects and celebrates
the differences among us.
How can we be together? In a unity. That is not simplistic.
That is not oppressive.
But rather. Complex. And emancipatory. Our unity.
Must be complex.
And emancipatory. And so.
I evoke.
The black feminist.
Audre Lorde.
The black lesbian feminist.
Audre Lorde.
Differences.
She wrote.
Must not be merely tolerated. But seen. As a fund of polarities. Between which.
Our creativity.
Can spark. Like a dialectic.
In this complex unity.
We say yes to life.
We say yes to life.
We say yes to community.
We say yes to community.
Yes to happiness.
Yes to happiness.
Yes to education.
Yes to education.
Free education.
Free education.
We say yes.
Yes.
We say yes. To economic.
To economic.
And racial.
And racial.
And gender.
And gender.
And sexual.
And sexual.
Equality.
Equality.
We say yes to the imagination.
We say yes to the imagination.
We say yes to creativity.
We say yes to creativity.
We say yes to hope.
We say yes to hope.
We say yes to the future.
We say yes to the future.
Finally, a few words about my hometown.
Finally, a few words about my hometown.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
About the police assault on Occupy Oakland.
Scott Olson
remains in the hospital. Oakland General Assembly met a few days ago in the park named for Oscar Grant and called
for a general strike.
A general strike. Throughout the city. On November 2nd. A general strike.
This is revolutionary.
The words of Angela Davis a couple days ago at Occupy Wall Street. This is Alan Minsky, and you are listening to Building a Powerful Movement in the United States of America. I'm joined now by Brian Holmes. Brian Holmes is, in my opinion, one of the most insightful analysts on the history of activism and protests in the entire post-industrial era, and also on the matter of art and aesthetics and how they can and do function as an oppositional practice in our age of hyper-commodification. Brian Holmes's blog is titled Continental Drift, The Other Side of Neoliberal Globalization, which you can find at brianholmes.wordpress.com, and he is the author most recently of the book Escape the Overcode, Activist Art in the Control Society. Brian Holmes was also one of the first people to lead an open forum at Occupy Wall Street. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Alan. These are interesting times we're living in.
And I think maybe a good way to have the audience be introduced to your thinking and ideas is to ask you to summarize what it is that you spoke about as you opened the open forum at Occupy Wall Street a couple weeks ago.
Well, my topic there was the end of the financialized mind and the transformation of global class structure. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that through the cycle of protests, which is now entering, let's say, its third year, beginning from 2008, beginning from the massive protests in Greece, and then followed by greater global extension of this new form of protesting in North Africa and throughout the Arab world, then coming back to Europe, you know, with the movement of the Indignados in Spain, and finally achieving its representation on the stage of New York City, the global financial capital, with Occupy Wall Street, we really have a rejection, not only in terms of theory, but in people's bodies and their minds and their hearts and in their behavior of the neoliberal order. And I think this is really, we're moving to the complete crisis of the neoliberal system that's been around since the 1980s and that has really structured society in depth. So to say that this is the end of the financialized mind is a welcome thing to be able to say, I think. It means that we could start imagining, not just imagining the world differently, but start to run the world differently. And I think that has everything to do with what has gradually become a very rigid and extremely hierarchical class structure, not only in the United States, but of course around the world.
Let me ask you this. The United States, if you go back in the history in post-industrial era, industrial era forward, there is this free-floating notion, sometimes attributed primarily to Marx, that the revolution, as it were, needs to take place in the most, quote-unquote, advanced industrialized technological society. And certainly the people who have advocated for neoliberal capitalism, not necessarily directly, have put forward the notion that the United States was that most advanced country and that its economy was something that needed to be modeled in the rest of the world. Given that I do think that this notion free floats, and you see it in the pages of The Economist, The Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal over the past few decades, how significant is it to finally have this movement gain so much traction among so broad a segment of the population and for it to be motivated by such committed activists sleeping out every night in the United States, right at the heart of global finance capital?
Well, I think you've said it all. I mean, the significance is there. Not only does that notion float in the journals of the 1%, but it has been cabled around the world. It has been built in the new city centers of what I call mega gentrification, which has been a transformation of the urban fabric to create, nodes of basically finance capital, of those highly technological, highly communicative downtown central business districts that control the development of entire countries, including our own, of course. And this transformation of the way the world is governed and the way that production actually takes place has been controlled through the global cities, particularly of New York and London, which produced both the techniques and the ideology that have really underlie the way that things get done nowadays. So it becomes much more serious for everyone in the world when there are revolts in these cities, and particularly in New York, because the United States combines this financial power with its military power and its policing power over the whole world system.
I'm going to ask you the... I wonder how many trillions and trillions of dollars they claim make up the global economy when you throw in all the worrying of financial transactions around the globe. So this is the multi-trillion dollar question. I thought it was framed beautifully by Slavoj Žižek at one of the open forums in New York, where he said, we live in a time, and maybe up until September 17th, we live or lived in a time in which it was easier to imagine the end of the world as a habitable sphere for humanity than to imagine the end of capitalism. Do you believe that what is transpiring now in the petri dish of this movement, not only in the United States but around the world, that the imagining of a post-capitalist society that will be attractive to draw more and more people in is beginning to take shape? Or is it too early to even think along those lines? Or is it just to point to that it is through this process of meeting people, talking to people at Occupy Spaces, that something can and maybe must emerge?
Well, it's not too early to think about it. It's far too early to proclaim it. Intellectuals, people who have enough time in their lives to devote to occupy their thoughts with the past and the future, need to think about a different way of governing our societies, and need to think about that practically. So that, I mean, by practically, I mean to begin with acts which are small and which are direct, but which open up and allow us to gradually, in fact, occupy spaces, transformative spaces that can go all the way towards different forms of administration. We live in complex societies. These societies are require a tremendous amount of social cooperation to reproduce themselves day by day and year by year. But what people in the world have become terribly aware of, that the way that we're running society now is a dead end. And so it is, in fact, very easy to imagine, increasingly easy to imagine the end of the world, somewhat as it was during the Cold War with the nuclear bomb. What has now opened up as a possibility and has been opening up over the last 10 years is the possibility of not continuing along this completely blind rush towards a progressively a world from which any possibility of happiness is banished by our own actions.
I'm speaking with Brian Holmes, who, among many things, is a professor of philosophy at the European Graduate School in Switzerland, and his blog, which is at brianholmes.wordpress.com, is Continental Drift, the Other Side of Neoliberal Globalization. You have spoken about and written eloquently about the liberatory, the freeing experience that people have when they participate in these movements that envision alternatives to the society in which people feel trapped inside of. You have spoken about this well before September 17th. What have you experienced directly in that regard in this contemporary Occupy movement? And maybe if you can tilt your response to the ears of people who maybe haven't participated in it yet.
Well, I think that there's been tremendous sentiment of relief that the mass media can transmit more or less directly the actions and the beliefs and the statements of people who are involved, not just in New York, but in all the different occupations around the United States. And so this leads to things which would have been considered incredible, that apparently a majority of people who are interviewed find one way or the other to support the occupiers. There's a feeling of relief there, because what's happening is that a form of censorship is being lifted, the censorship that disallowed any possibility of critiquing the entire system and not just one action or one politician or one party. And that kind of critique comes from, I think, all levels of society, you know, and quite a lot of what are called ordinary people. That is to say, people you don't know, people who you don't think like these people. You know, we live in a very diverse society, right? That so many people should support these occupations is a liberatory experience, and it's felt on the ground when the character of the demonstrations now is very, very different. These demonstrations, as opposed to the ones that took place during the dark years of the Bush administration, these demonstrations show a feeling of, a kind of optimism that comes not from fantasy, but that comes from being able to look the problems in the face with other people who feel similarly inclined. And I think you feel that even through the distant echoes that one receives in any number of newspapers or radio stations and so on.
And you mentioned a few minutes ago the role of intellectuals, the people who do have the free time to reflect on these matters. The American educational system and pedagogy in general in the United States, in spite of the really absolutely well-intentioned effort of millions of teachers across the country, has morphed into something that has been somewhat abominable, whether it's a matter of test scores or just the access to quality education only for those with deep pockets. What role do you think the movement can play moving forward, and what role do you see yourself playing in terms of creating public universities, as it were?
Well, this, I think, is a major problem in a complex technological society like ours, which has really devoted increasing really quantities of people, I mean, huge percentages, you know, maybe a third of the population is dedicated to what are ultimately intellectual operations, the kind of things you learn at universities. Now, universities have been vastly restructured since the 60s. The institution of higher learning has been transformed so as to really individualize everyone involved and privatize every relationship that one has with these institutions. That goes from the loans that students personally negotiate and pay, pay through yet more endless personal negotiations for 20 or 30 years, sometimes after their education is over, to the very top where the, you know, administrators are wringing six-figure salaries out of public universities. We're talking high six figures, 500,000 and above, you know, to the professors who are encouraged in the sciences and even in the arts to create intellectual property and sell it to big corporations for their own personal benefit and for the benefit of the universities. So everyone ends up being caught in a very highly structured sort of a web that at once freezes them in their position and separates them from everyone else. And I think this is the reason why the universities have been able to play such a small role in any kind of contestation. There are, of course, many professors who are doing a great job analyzing the situation as it develops year by year and decade by decade, and that analytical help is absolutely invaluable and should never be diminished in any way, I don't think. But as a social institution, we do not see the universities really producing solutions to what has become what's now recognized as the takeover of our society by the 1%, which becomes very much a ruling class in our society. So what do we need to do? I think there are many things that can be done, and I don't think the story of this can be written in advance because the movement that's now unfolding and others that will unfold in the upcoming years may change everything for the better. But I think one way to start is for people who are involved with the production of discourse, with writing, with critical writing, to form groups which are at least partially outside the strictures of university control. And I say partially because I'm not talking about isolating oneself in society and in small sectarian groupings where you end up creating a really apocalyptic nightmares when you're faced sort of all alone with the huge problems of American society. I'm more talking about a relative autonomy from which far more deeply critical positions can be generated and which can serve as a source of inspiration, as a place of freedom, as another stage almost on which to elaborate critical thinking and to connect it to action. And so for that reason, with a group of people here in Chicago, for instance, we've just begun a seminar this semester, which is called Three Crises, 30s, 70s, Today, and which is dedicated to a sort of preliminary type of mapping of what goes on in a major crisis of the capitalist political economy, like the one we're now traversing, which only comes around every 40 or 50 years. And I think that this type of group is something that we hope to discover already emerging in other parts of the country, and our aim is indeed to constitute a kind of network of which where we can be a part among, you know, and alongside many other people in different cities. So that project, Three Crises, can be found on the webpage of a self-managed cultural center called Mess Hall, and it's at messhall.org. And you can see there a little tab for the Three Crises project.
Right, and you can also find links to it at Continental Drift, which is the URL is brianholmes.wordpress.com. It is Brian's blog, as it were, Continental Drift, the other side of neoliberal globalization. But by searching Mess Hall as well, Brian, they can find the Three Crises.
Yeah, it's easy to find, messhall.org.
Well, Brian Holmes, I have so many things I could talk with you about. We have to run off to an exciting thing that came out of the Oakland General Assembly yesterday. I don't know if you heard about it, the Declaration of Solidarity with Neighborhood Reclamations, in which the Oakland General Assembly is going to work to assist the efforts of the people of Oakland to occupy and use abandoned property, which, as you can imagine, there is a proliferation of such properties in Oakland, California. So we're going to move on to that. But, Brian, I really want to thank you for joining us here on Building a Powerful Movement in the United States. And I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yes, thank you. Solidarity with everyone for tomorrow, the Metropolitan Strike.
There we go. Yes, and by the way, your essay on Metropolitan Strikes, I think, again, people should check out at brianholmes.wordpress.com. Thank you so much, Brian.
Bye-bye, Anna.
And we're going to go now to a focus segment on the Declaration of Solidarity with Neighborhood Reclamations. I did speak with one of the people who was involved in composing the Declaration, a poet and a professor at the University of California, Davis, by the name of Joshua Clover. But I'll go to that in a second. He was on a train, and that truncated the length of our conversation. So let me read first to you the Declaration, which was passed by the Oakland General Assembly with a 91% approval yesterday night. The Declaration of Solidarity with Neighborhood Reclamations. Occupy Oakland, in solidarity with the Occupy movement and with the local community, has established the principle of claiming, for open use, the open space that has been kept from us. We are committed to helping this practice continue and grow. Here in Oakland, thousands of buildings owned by the city, by banks, and by corporations stand idle and abandoned. At the same time, social services such as child and health care, education, libraries, and community spaces are being defunded and eliminated. Occupy Oakland supports the efforts of people in all Oakland neighborhoods to reclaim abandoned properties for use to meet their immediate needs. Such spaces are already being occupied and squattered unofficially by the dispossessed, the marginalized, by many of the people who have joined together here in Oscar Grant Plaza to make this a powerful and diverse movement. We commit to providing political and material support to neighborhood reclamations and supporting them in the face of eviction threats or police harassment. In solidarity with the global occupation movement, we encourage the transformation of abandoned spaces into resource centers towards meeting urgent community needs that the current economic system cannot and will not provide. I spoke with Joshua Clover, again, a poet who is also a professor at the University of California at Davis, about what motivated this particular declaration of solidarity.
I think that a couple of different things motivated this proposal. The first was a sense of the tradition that we were inheriting, that Occupy Oakland was itself something that came out of a larger Occupy movement, not just Wall Street, but the events that have been happening, the movement of the squares in Europe and Tahrir Square in Egypt, and the sense that this attempt to reclaim space that was not being used for the people to meet their needs and to figure out how to go forward in a world that was not caring for them, that this was a tradition moving around the globe, and that we had come out of it at Occupy Oakland and had experienced a lot of support from other such places, both domestically and internationally. And so we wanted to continue that chain and to offer that support to other people, both locally and elsewhere, who wanted to open up spaces that were not being used to meet their needs, to meet their needs. And, of course, we know that many people now are living in a world of profoundly unmet needs. So that was one sense, was to honor the tradition we were coming out of and to try and keep it going and to try and continue that chain and that movement. And I think that the other reason was simply the sense of, you know, immediate sort of shock and, excuse me for the train sound, a sense of immediate shock and deep dissatisfaction that so many spaces owned by banks, by corporations, by the city were effectively going unused in a time when people deeply had need for shelter, for places to sleep, to eat, to organize, to talk, to begin a new politics, which is what this is about. And we wanted to be very much in support of that and of an expansion of this movement rather than just sort of a static sense of moving from park to park or plaza to plaza, to extend it out into the community and into the structures and edifices that would be available for the meeting of those needs. So that was the impulse for putting together this proposal. Several people put it together in writing, but it came out of a large group of people who were interested in seeing this happen. And I was on the team that brought it before the General Assembly, although I can't claim any credit for its authorship.
And that is Joshua Clover, who is a poet and professor at the University of California, Davis. I spoke to him while he was on the Amtrak train from the Bay Area to Davis, and unfortunately the phone line dropped out. So that was all I was able to speak with him about today. But it's about the Declaration of Solidarity with neighborhood reclamations that was passed yesterday by the Oakland GA. This is about all of that unoccupied property, with all the people who are homeless, all the people who've been unable to maintain their rent, have moved in with family members, or are splitting apartments up and living not in the way they'd like to, with rents high and housing prices artificially high, with properties being held off the market. It seems quite inhumane that the economic order that we currently live in is not allowing access to property that stands idle, and the Occupy Oakland General Assembly has passed this declaration, and one can only think about some of the areas of Southern California with so much unoccupied property out along the periphery, out in Antelope Valley, why people, I think, would be living like kings if everybody could share the property that does exist, in contrast to having the severe crisis of homelessness that does exist in the society. I'm now joined by Alejandra Cruz. And Alejandra Cruz, she is one of the people who is going to have a press conference today at 4 p.m. to announce a solidarity march with Occupy Oakland that will take place tomorrow, tomorrow in the late afternoon. And it is also a march against police brutality. Welcome to KPFK, Alessandra.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the situations that's been something of a paradox here in Southern California, and quite a paradox given the history of police brutality in Southern California, really right up into the present when you look at what's been going on in the county jails with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. The Los Angeles Police Department has not responded to the really significant in size encampment that is on the grounds of City Hall, in contrast, say, to really now a growing list of cities, Chicago, Boston, New York, Atlanta, Nashville, Denver, Oakland, and those are the only ones that come to mind. And, of course, Oakland with the most extreme example to date of severe police brutality against the occupations. It strikes me that the fact that this hasn't happened here is no reason at all not to bring up the issue of police brutality. So perhaps maybe you can explain the group that you've been working with, their feelings about this issue, and the action that is planned for tomorrow.
Yeah, so we started on the second day of the occupation, on October 2nd, we started the committee to end police brutality because we really did feel that the potential of the Occupy movement in Los Angeles was being held down by certain people who helped prop themselves up as spokespeople for the movement. And those same people had agendas that included bringing the police into our movement, not as, you know, individual participants, but as an institution to kind of monitor what we're doing, make sure that we didn't pose a threat to, you know, business as usual downtown. And we thought that kind of was in contradiction to what the movement stood for in Wall Street and across the country. And so, you know, we wanted to bring some of the power and energy from Los Angeles in terms of, you know, communities who come out against anti-immigrant legislation, communities that come out against impounds of our cars, against street vendors, you know, the communities that are against police brutality, and bring that power and energy to the Occupy site.
Now, it does strike me that a movement that is committed to nonviolence, you know, it'd just be the order of the day that such a movement would make strong declarations against police brutality. Again, especially in a region which has such a really high-profile history. I don't think anybody who's aware of Southern California in any way, shape, or form doesn't know about the history of police brutality in Southern California. And again, as I just mentioned, all the way right up into the present. So, you know, maybe what is the substance of your declaration as you're making it right now?
We're basically saying that we really believe in the Occupy movement, and we believe that the energy from people who came out in 2006 against the anti-immigrant legislation, who came out in the millions, the people who were repressed May 1st, 2007, the people who came out against the murder by LAPD of Manuel Jimenez last year in the Westlake area, that we do have something to offer this movement. And if you know, we're going to be a part of this movement, we need to bring our issues fighting police brutality to the forefront, because, you know, it's not only part of our agenda as a community in Los Angeles, but also part of the national and international support for the Wall Street movement. So we just want to, you know, have people come out to the march. And, you know, a lot of us saw what was happening in Oakland. I got, like, text messages throughout the night when the police were cracking down there from my friends in Oakland. And, you know, we were worried about what was happening with how brutal the police were. And we, you know, we saw them come back and forth. We saw thousands of them march through the night the next night and then retake Oscar Grant Plaza the night following that. And, you know, we feel like in Los Angeles, we have felt a little bit, you know, isolated from this larger movement. But, you know, with Oakland leading the way, it really inspired us to kind of insert ourselves into the national Occupy movement as a strong force. And I think this march can be a stepping stone in building the type of networks that we need to create that kind of solidarity.
You know, I think your analysis strikes me as very accurate, and I have spoken to you before and we're short on time. So let me just say this about my impressions about Occupy Oakland. I actually was up in the Bay Area at the very end of September. The movement was, in terms of internal critique that was taking place within the movement, there was a lot of discussion in the period from September 17th for about the next month across the country that the movement was largely led by people who came from the middle class. They were disproportionately not people of color, and that this was something that was spoken of as well in the Bay Area. But over these past 2 weeks, at least in terms of Occupy Oakland, that really seems to have changed, that the imagination of the broader community is really captivated by Occupy Oakland. So, first of all, do you concur? Secondly, do you think that is still not the case in Southern California? And there's a huge question with about 2 minutes left, Alejandra. What do you think might attract the broad community of working people in Southern California to the movement in the way that I'm positing has happened in Oakland?
I think that people were initially turned away with kind of turned away by the kind of festival, non-political atmosphere that was happening at Occupy LA. But in the last week, it really has shifted. There's more of a serious political communal spirit. There's more actions that are being planned to, you know, march on the banks on Friday and to continue with the march Wednesday at 5:30. We're going to meet up. And we're just, you know, a lot of people who left are coming back because of that. And a lot of the people who propped themselves up as authority but were really kind of speaking heads, kind of, you know, trying to prop up their own political career, they're moving to the side. Their authority isn't working because people are coming together in a way that is far more real and far more important than those people. And I just think I want, you know, we want to see more people come out to the march, but we're going to continue to outreach. We put out, you know, communications in Spanish. We are all over, you know, Boyle Heights, East LA, South LA, you know, building for this march. And, you know, we're going to continue to bring that spirit in. So I think there's already a shift because of Oakland and because of what's been happening across the country. But I think that we can continue to build it larger.
And tomorrow there is going to be a mass march in solidarity with Occupy Oakland protests. According to this press release, it meets at 5:30 p.m. at Occupy LA, which is, of course, at 1st and Spring Street, in where City Hall is. And the march begins at 6 p.m. And there's also a press conference today at 4 p.m. at Occupy LA. Again, this one's actually at 1st and Main at City Hall, where you people are interested could probably hear more from Alejandra and other people who are participating in the committee to end police brutality at Occupy LA. And all that information was correct. Is that right, Alejandra?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so the march is tomorrow, which, of course, up in Oakland is the day there was a call for a general strike. And Alejandra Cruz, who is a member of the Committee to End Police Brutality at Occupy LA, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on KPFK.
Thank you.